In the studio, I've got Renata. Good morning.
Good. Atamari e koutou ma. Ai, ngā mihi nui ki a koutou I tēnei ata. Great to be back in the studio. I missed my cue for our last interview because I was in the beautiful, beautiful land place called Akaroa. In the South Island,
right.
To Waipounamu on a very special kaupapa with some of our very own community. I was, apart from visiting, of course, I have a beautiful cousin who lives in Akaroa itself, and so my daughter and I, Komako, made the journey down there. But some of that time there was also dedicated to a kaupapa to do with an earth treasure vase, which... from our community, Therese was the custodian, Therese and Itai, and they'd had this this vessel, it's a ipu, made from uku, and it had to do with world peace, and it needed to be placed in the Earth Mother Papatuanuku in Aotearoa. Well, it had that desire, but that took probably two years of ceremony with community, and this community was introduced to this earth treasure vase some time ago when Itai and Therese brought it to Whaingaroa.
Yeah, from Israel?
From Nepal.
From Nepal, okay, right.
Nepalese origins, a very large international group of people, community, who have been part of that story, that kaupapa for quite a while, and ensuring that these earth treasure vases are placed in different countries and have their goodness to bring world peace.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so the two-year journey, it was created 2 years ago in Nepal, and...
This particular vase was made in Nepal by a lama, by a Nepalese monk, out of uku, out of clay, and then it makes this journey through. I don't really know all the in-depth details, but I understand it comes through Tibetan Buddhist teachings, and then makes its way out into the world through custodian. Those who feel they can hold that that taonga, and it came to Whaingaroa, and there was a time when we thought it would be taken to the far north, but that didn't occur, and so Therese had the very deep inspiration for it to be placed in Akaroa, in Te Waipounamu, at a very special time. What I understand was she had this inspiration that it was when the seals had their pups, and so we were there in Akaroa staying at the most extraordinary marae called Onuku. It was a great privilege to be in this six-star marae, and
let's call it six.
It was extraordinary, and had all the bells and whistles that you can imagine, and they basically welcomed us open-hearted and then just said, we'll come back in 2 days and farewell you, and, you know, you carry on with your kaupapa. They didn't leave us, they basically said, the marae is yours to use. It was a small rōpū, about 10 of us. Who stayed there and were able to find that place where the earth treasure vase would have its final home, so as a physical manifestation of rangimārie, of peace.
And so did you make contact with the hapū down there and talk
yes.
And they were open to the kaupapa?
Yes, they were. They're extraordinary people. I must say they were very open, you know. They were, when I explained what our intention was, they said, "Oh, that's fine. you know, didn't say it so much as emailed it. Yes.
Yeah, fair enough. It's the modern world.
I wouldn't say I had the personal contact, although I think through my cousin who's been down there for many years, that was definitely a big plus. It's an extraordinary place, Akaroa. And I keep saying that, but I now know.
You've been. And then does the message come back to Nepal that one of their peace, we call it a peace vase?
Yes, Earth Treasure Vase.
Has found its place?
No, the Lama actually came down. He was there.
Right.
He came all the way. He has a centre in Christchurch.
Mm.
So he was travelling, he travelled all the way from Nepal and was able to accompany us into Onuku Marae. So that was beautiful. It was really beautiful to meet him.
Mm.
And it's other people. There was a Stephen who'd come from Japan. He came to be part of the Ropu. It's my understanding is it's quite an extensive group from all over the world who have this desire, and they focus on this kaupapa of the earth treasure vases so that they can generate this extraordinary depth of intention for us to hold a peaceful existence on the earth.
And how did you become involved, or why did you want to be involved?
Well, you know, I mean, Therese and Itai are very dear friends, and through that connection in this community and the Earth Treasure Vase coming to different ceremonies, seasonal ceremonies, I was present when the vase was making its journey into our community by way of person in circles and healing circles where it would be held and by each person. So time was taken for that to occur, and that's how I really became involved.
And can you explain for Western scientific kind of the mindset the significance of this?
And
I don't mean that to be like a sarcastic comment. I think it really needs to be communicated.
Okay, the best way I can feel or understand the intention of an Earth Treasure Vase, it's been handled by humans, and the intentions of the humans is towards this intention.
Mm.
It could have been an envelope. It could have been another form of taonga, but it was created in Nepal out of uku, out of hene uku, out of clay. And so it was to make this long journey with a custodian, a kaitiaki. And, of course, Therese and Itai were the perfect. Well, they chose. The vase chose them and they chose the vase. My understanding would be that it's the intention of people that we're really nurturing and nourishing, that we have this. It could have been a tokotoko, which is a talking stick. It could have been a piece of ponamu, that would have made also held this, but it was come from a fairly specific spiritual origins, Tibetan Buddhist teachings, and from the depth of that spiritual history, the infusion of human kindness and thought patterns was to bring community together at different times and then return the taonga to Papatuanuku, the Earth Mother. I understand those things, and that it had such a deep intention for peaceful existence on the earth, of all life, not just human life. So there are many layers that I understand.
Yeah.
about that. You know, being in Te Waipounamu for me, the land itself is a huge piece of Pounamu, and it's unique to Te Waipounamu. And just by the sheer fact that we have this this unique taonga that's created by water in our presence, and the way that we care for it, and the Ngāi Tai people have definitely got their finger on that pulse. You know, it's not a market. It's not only a marketable taonga where people can mine parts of it can be mined and made into something you can wear, or you know, as a gift to a mokopuna. It has to also live in the earth, and much of it will remain there because that's where it belongs. That's where it, you know, I've gone off on a Māori.
we've gone a long way, because I remember we were talking before we went on there about what we were going to talk about, but that was, I thought that was something worth dwelling on. Doing something that has an inspiration of peace behind it seems like a good thing.
At the moment,
a good thing to dwell on for a bit?
Yeah, we need to dwell on it quite seriously in all ways, in all manner of ways that we can think of. Perhaps not so much thinking as well, more spontaneously responding rather than reacting, using that part of our being to just go, oh. And then speak, perhaps, you know, the exchange of kōrero between us, how we do that, our understanding of, you know, one of the big kaupapas this year has been around education, de-schooling, unschooling, reschooling, you name it, there's a word that expresses what it is, but what does it look like as we pull apart this thing we call educating our tamariki?
Yeah.
You know, mainstream, you know, you have bilingualism, you have kura kaupapa Māori, and then you have this huge inspiration for tamariki who are not involved in that system, who have left that particular system to create other systems. They're actually creating other systems. that appear and obviously nourish and nurture different ways of learning that are, I wouldn't say they're unstructured, but definitely they offer other ways of learning to the generation, to our mokopuna, so they can expand. I think we're looking for expansion on ways of learning.
People often want to know about structure, but I would say the difference is in where the impetus comes from for the learning. The impetus in one system comes from outside the student, and in the systems you're talking about, the impetus would ideally come from within the student. The desire to learn and the motivation comes from within rather than from outside.
Yeah, and I think that we have had a unique opportunity here in Whangaroa for that to occur by spontaneous desire for people to regroup and to offer their particular pūkenga, their skills, to quite a wide age group. And this has all really been pushed forward by post, dare I say it, COVID. We're not in a post-COVID situation, by the way. It's right there with us as well. You know,
we're mentally we're still there.
No, I think there's still a lot we're dealing with. There are communities who are pretty down with being unwell in terms of that. Just on a biological.
Okay. Yeah.
Journey. Yeah. We mustn't just. We're done with that. That wasn't great. But you know, no, we're not done with it. It's right there. We must be mindful and continue to navigate those that biological taniwha.
Yeah. That's as good a word as any, I think.
For
what that was. Yeah. Or is.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, do we want to move on to?
Well, I think it's for me...
The first thing we were going to talk about.
It was reflection on the past year with all the different ups and downs that have within our own community around rethinking, recalibrating how we live in our own hapuri. One of the things I'm really curious about is that there's been a lot of micro communities. There's definitely a lot of communities in this place we called Whangaroa that perhaps are not connected to, towards, you know.
And I feel like it has been like that for a long time here, but maybe you're thinking it's become more so over the last little while?
I think separation has become quite obvious to me.
Yeah.
The division, what I call division, you know, the, I don't know, the Red Sea.
the many Red Seas. There's a Red Sea for everyone.
We, you know, generally divide.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I think that's actually quite clear. People are actually more coming forward and naming, you know, their parts that weren't named before. And one of them, and you know, dare I say it, but you know, you meet vegan friendly, you know. And there was a time not that long ago where I would have thought, what's that, but it's now part of our language of communities, you know, vegan friendly food. Or and you go, am I okay to bring, what does that mean? I better have a look up. And you know, I'm part of a community, but they want vegan-friendly food. I go, okay, so it's about the food. I said, okay, I can jam with that. it's probably not something we would do on a marae. We wouldn't speak about our marae as, you know, bring a vegan-friendly dish.
Yeah.
It's not something, maybe, I've not heard it yet though. It's basically, you know, you're our manuhiri, we'll feed you, we'll try and cater for your needs. But yeah, the vegan, you know, yeah, that's basically where we're coming from. So hope you get well fed because, you know, we really want to take care of you. So that whole defining of food.
Right.
Organic, permaculture, you know, that's all part of this community. And I think it's a very beautiful offering, but some of us are still navigating. What does that mean? Oh, can I afford that? Can I afford that?
Yeah.
Probably not. You know, it's become marketable.
So this is like one aspect of...
It's one aspect of our communities, and I'd like to, you know, invite us to perhaps find ways of becoming more joining together. I'm not sure how that's going to happen. I'm not sure. Got any ideas?
I was going to say sit down and have a meal, but...
Yeah, that would be great. That would be great, and or have more regular meals. You know what Jono was doing, Jono and Saras, beautiful offering. That was just such the coolest thing.
So that was Monday evenings down at tiny shop.
We were devoted to that.
And Jono will be doing. He said to me they'll be doing. I think they'll be doing that again in the new year, but they're having a break at the moment.
Of course, I mean because that offering not only was it, you know, an offering to our community, but there's a story behind it. There's a beautiful story, you know, and hard work to be there, you know, that commitment, dedication, and we were definitely receivers of that goodness and really, you know, really support that, those kaupapa in our community, and long may they last.
Yeah.
Yeah. At a grassroots level, flax roots level.
So the reason you mentioned the vegan friendly food was that people might interpret that as saying that you don't like that, but I don't think that's what you're saying.
No. No, not at all. You know, when I was 16 years old, I'm the oldest daughter of 11 children. I have an older brother.
Yeah.
My parents decided that I was a candidate for boarding school. And the boarding school I was sent to from the far north, we were living at that time in a little valley called Takahui, north of Kaitaia, and I was sent all the way down to Palmerston North. I agreed to go because it meant that I didn't have to look after the kids and hang out all the washing.
All your little siblings.
and you know, peel pots and pots of potatoes and kumara every evening. And I kind of went, yeah, I'll go to boarding school. But it was a vegetarian boarding school. And I spent 2 years there, but so not at all. I've had an early training in what a form of vegetarianism looks like. And, yeah, I went with it. I mean, it was food. I ate it and I enjoyed it. And
so you really have probably arrived in a very different culture, not just different food, but a very different environment.
Yes, I did. Yeah. It was very, very Pākehā middle class. The girls that were in the dormitory were well off.
Yeah.
And I didn't come from so well off. I didn't have a pair of slippers or a dressing gown. And they all didn't. I remember really clearly, like, sitting in my room with my roommate and going, I'm going to write to my mum and let her know I'm not leaving my room until she sends me a pair of slippers and a dressing gown. I wanted to be like them.
I didn't know that everyone
was supposed to have a pair of slippers and a dressing gown because it wasn't normal in our household. There was 11 kids.
I shifted school between fifth form and sixth form, and I went from a school where it was all right for boys to wear sandals to a school where it wasn't all right for boys to wear sandals. And this seems stupid now that I'm in my 50s, but back then that was a significant thing that I had to negotiate, you know, in the first week of in this new place.
Yeah, I was not only a survivor in those rules, if you like, of that particular boarding school, but I was a thriver. I also negotiated my time there and decided I was going to make the very best of it, and and I thrived, absolutely thrived, because I chose to. I thought, okay, my parents have sent me here for all the right reasons, I think, and then go to my room and howl my eyes out because thinking, oh, but where's all the people, where's all my kids, my siblings that I'm supposed to be looking after? And I didn't have to look after anyone except me. I had to look after me, and that wasn't used to that.
Mm.
So I was 16.
It's kind of good to have experiences like that once you get to a certain age, I think, in your teen years, something to become aware as early as possible that there's so many different ways of living out there and that people are all living them, and just to be aware of it, I think.
Yeah, well, I had a purpose as well. You know, I wanted to graduate from my studies. And I was being given an opportunity, and it was quiet. You know, if you can imagine a household of a minimum of 13 people every day growing up, not, you know, I mean, the kids got born each year, or every 2 years, mum would have
another one.
So those things I immediately found scary first, because I wasn't used to no waking up and there's not babies crying or
wake up in silence.
Yeah, it was quite quiet, and I thought, okay, so this is how some people live. They actually live like this. Mm. They're used to much quiet, and they also spoke to you quietly. So I wasn't aware, because to be honest, you know, yeah, my parents were under a lot of stress with a large family, and and voices were raised.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
So boarding school was like, oh, you don't have to actually yell at people. Yeah, you know, yell to be heard.
Yeah.
So that was a whole dynamics that I came to understand on a very much deeper level through that, and then subsequent experiences like, oh, people actually talk to you quite quietly.
Were they like, who's this loud person with no slippers who's come to us?
I was pretty quiet, pretty shy, really.
Yeah, I bet.
But
yeah.
just many different things like that that I was unaware of, that my awareness was brought to, and being Māori in a very, very big non-Māori community, and the regulating of that was through going to church on Saturday.
Right.
That was one of the features.
Yeah. Oh, was that a Seventh-day Adventist?
That was a Seventh-day Adventist boarding school.
Yeah. So that, but that must give you now the ability to cross into different cultures within our, you know, within Aotearoa.
I do my best.
Easily. I think you're here with me, you know, and you.
I'm here with you. It's true.
Well, I hope I'm not that difficult. You know, I don't know. Anyway, like, but we need people like that in this country at this time, I think.
Yeah, I think crossing between has been a definitely a skill and a gift of bridging that I can navigate.
Yeah.
From those early trainings.
Yeah.
I'm probably more likely, because of that early training, I call it, to respond rather than react. And so I realised as life went on, you know, I'll be honest with you, you know, my siblings were a very reactionary in my eyes.
Yeah.
I'd go, hey, wait a minute, that's pretty bad. You know, a situation would arise. I said, but hang on a minute. Just back off and think about it. Oh, no, I'm not going to, you know. And the voices would go up, and the blood pressure, and a hot. And that was it, end of story for me. I was no longer required to assist, because I didn't know that way of being so out of sorts. I'd been given some significant training, and like, just back off a bit, think about it, and respond.
So did your family think that you had changed when you came back from boarding school?
Oh, totally, totally. I know, even probably to this day, like, oh, yeah, you know, they, not that we talk about it, it's not about talking about what life, about me in a certain way, but I definitely have shied away from many, many situations which I consider to be fired up by anger, and it's something I've had to try and understand too on another, you know, on other levels of intergenerational trauma within my own people.
Yeah.
And the reason for that around colonization and how that has impacted so much on the well-being on so many different levels, and to have a much deeper understanding of that. But you know, I certainly would like to see some major changes for our people to be experience vitality and wellness.
Do you feel like you have left the intergenerational trauma behind for your life?
Left it behind,
or what's the word? Not processed it, or something done? Brought it to bed, or.
I'm really,
I don't know what the phrase is I'm looking for.
Yeah,
but.
I have. What it has helped me to do is develop what I call a compassion, very deep compassion. So rather than an acknowledgement of like, I don't know what to do about that, but I do have other skills that I can contribute, which are of a different nature. You know, like, they're not political, if you like. Then, you know, I'm not going to get on the radio and start dividing people, you know.
Yeah.
Saying, oh, those Pākehās over there, it's not my nature. But it definitely is right there within my own whānau very quickly. You know, they'll, go to that kind of understanding or rhythm. I don't propose that's a solution or a way forward. So yes, I would say I project more of a trying to understand and have compassion. But yeah, Some days I just wish it would all go away and that we'd help.
Yes.
All go away and I wouldn't feel so sad. I feel deep sadness as well for the loss, because loss of land is an extraordinary thing to live with when you realised, when you travel the breadth of Aotearoa and you realise that our people came here to live on this land, and then very quickly as they negotiated a partnership that was considered, there are many, so many stories that have still to be told about how they were, the land was just completely taken away from them, and that was fine, that was okay to do that, and still today those stories are untold.
And I think we understand, like Pākehā, most Pākehā in New Zealand understands that's the kind of the story of how the nation came together. But the thing I've been learning is that every little community and every little valley and every little bay and has a story, and there are thousands and upon thousands of stories like that, and the people in that little valley experience, that was their experience and their story. And because I've learned some of the stories of what's happened around Whangaroa, certainly not all of them, I imagine. But yeah, every little piece of land has its own story.
Yes, it does. And I think it's who tells the story and how they tell it, to invite people there, because they're the stories of the land and the healing that's to take place, so that we get a really, a perspective that with understanding. So we really understand what's really going on. It's not just, them again. Yeah, we've got to have to much deeper reflection on land, the base of land, you know, and how that is something to be respected. So our relationship to Papa Tuanuku, our Earth Mother, is an essential ingredient in us living on this land peacefully. And so we create our communities. We have like a community that moves out into farmlands, and they're not interested in becoming farmers. They don't come from generations of farmers. They actually want to completely turn that whenua around and reforest it with natives.
Yeah.
With natives. I mean, whew.
Does this surprises you that this happened? This has happened in your lifetime?
Well, it's like, the deforestation was to take away that whole landscape because it didn't have an economic value. And now there's this, oh my gosh, what have we done? Now we have to put it all back together again. You know, we've got to, and so the reforestation is like we sell the trees back to ourselves that we actually were part of, our ancestors destroyed.
So this is a bit like the Europeans arrived and took all the trees away and turned it into farmland, and now you're looking and their descendants are now going back and putting it back into forest.
Their descendants have nurseries, have native plant nurseries as a sideline, which is growing, and it's becoming they're making decisions around the economic value of the native trees, and we can actually grow these and we can harvest them in 30 years, and so we'll do that. And I'm going, no, we're reforesting so that the forests remain this time. And, you know, we cannot have back what we had before, but we can definitely go a long way to providing the land with Papa Tuanuku, with her korowai again, for so many reasons. You know, landslides. What a great solution. Put the trees back
on the land. Yeah. Or that we all know what colour the water is that goes into the harbour after a storm if there's no trees on, no forest anywhere near
the
creeks.
I think that's been across to bear with, particularly my people in the far north have told that story so many times. You know, I can hear my father speaking about it long before the Western scientists came in and said, hey, you know, we just want to come to the marae and have a kōrero about what we've found out scientifically about the streams. And we're going, oh, we already know. Our kaumātua told us about what was happening up upriver and how we're not allowed to drink the water. And we just said, nah, that's not true. And they told us. And now you want to what? You want to come and tell us what sort of germs are in the water? Oh, we don't need to know that. All we know is it's poisonous, and that if our grandchildren or our children drink it, they're going to be actually sick for the rest of their lives. Is that scientific enough for you? Oh, you know.
The I was just thinking, when you go through Dargaville, the colour of the I don't know whether it's the harbour at that point or still the river, but the Kaipara Harbour is very brown. I know there's people out there working on it at the moment, actually. I must say that I've heard that, but yeah.
There's some people who are devoted to Papatuanuku and their local communities and the way that that unfolds. And there's new initiatives and people within our own community who are definitely part of that healing, the healing of the land. I think that's a major focus that has to happen if we are to go forward with any sanity, really, and to actually continue to live on this earth and have a reasonable life.
So how can you sell this idea of healing the land to a culture that is like the Western scientific culture, or no, that's a culture that sees the land as a resource? Can you sell this idea of healing the land to that culture, or do you need to change that culture?
So what's happening in Aotearoa currently and is going to continue to happen is the attraction of other Indigenous people to Aotearoa is actually probably a gift to the land, because they see and they understand from their own loss in their own countries, and often they're opening liners, this is a beautiful land. And I said, it was extremely beautiful. Mm. What you're seeing is the remnants of a beautiful land. And they said, yes, we know that. They're quite aware, so they're also willing to listen more to the Indigenous stories and have empathy and compassion and to join forces and to bring in their goodness into this beautiful land, this landscape we call Aotearoa. And I think that's been a necessary part of our going forward, is that sharing of those stories. So that there's, I'd like to see more of a genuine interest in taking on some of the beautiful aspects of us, of our culture, within their own lives going forward in our communities, you know, not just come here and hang out here for 6 months and then go back to their own countries, but to have a genuine connection to learning our stories and diving a bit more into our culture.
Like, I guess that's the definition of a tourist, is one who comes and passes through. But I thought you were also talking about people who are immigrating here. Yeah,
there's going to be more and more. People are just so attracted to this land. And I do believe that it's got to do with that they understand that, they say, oh, you Māori people, you're warriors, aren't you? Earth warriors. I said, yeah, our mother is really essential to us. So I'm not really about what, you know, originally you were asking about how do you change. Well, I'm not really interested in changing, what I see the recent English Queen, what she was promoting here. You know, she's passed on, and I'm not interested at all in what she was promoting here.
Which was?
Division. Division of people and wealth, and extreme wealth belongs to, you know, a hierarchy of a, you know, the
So she represents that concept and system.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she wore it in her crown, didn't she? All the jewels were stolen from other cultures.
Yeah,
you know, it's a fact. It's not a mythology. It's an absolute fact. So
yeah,
there was built on the stolen taonga of Indigenous people. No, I'm not. That's not my jam.
It's a real statement, actually. I hadn't really thought about that. But, yeah, stolen the wealth, and your queen wears it on her head. That's a really powerful statement about who's ruling.
Powers, they ruled in a particular manner, which was probably, they'd call it hearty, I would say.
That's a very generous way of describing it.
Well, they would see it that way because, you know, they maintained their wealth through, like, making sure that you didn't have what actually belonged to you. They made sure.
Yes, but they told themselves they were bringing everyone the benefits of their civilization. We don't need to go into that. That's what was going on in their heads at the time.
Yeah, I don't share the way that she, dare we call it the Commonwealth. I think in my lifetime and beyond, that whole Commonwealth will change, and countries like Te Papakanui a Māori, which is Australia, and ourselves, we will re-establish ourselves and have our own governing way of governing our own country and say, you stay over there. You look after your own people, your own country.
So I'm just trying to tie that back in because I've created another segue somewhere else. You were just referring to...
Well, I think it's, for me, it's about the loss...
You're not trying to fight that.
No, I think it's about it's about looking at what we actually still have here. And we're the, not only the renaissance of Te Ao Māori, but the goodness that has come... We're still holding these kete of beautiful mātauranga to offer to our communities. But we just need, you know, that genuine, people who are really open to receiving that and to holding that, you know, becoming custodians.
So you, and I guess, does this tie into, like, your te reo classes that you do?
Yeah.
And the people who are interested, they can come.
Yeah, have genuine interest in the language, you know, not just a, you know, oh, I've done a 5-week course.
That's not how you learn a language, no.
Not at all.
I mean,
not
it's a start. It's a start.
It's a very, very small start.
Yeah.
A genuine is, like, you know, really fight for it so that it becomes a really important part of who you are. You know, you can be on this land and say, yeah, my children are bilingual or trilingual. You know, they're also learning a language from my country.
Which is what European children do. They learn, especially, like, I have friends from Scandinavia, and they'll learn two languages.
Their own language from their own Scandinavian.
Three. They learn their Scandinavian language, not like Norwegian or Swedish. They'll learn English for practical reasons, and they'll learn a third language just for the love of it, or because you become a person with a wider worldview by doing it. You know, all sorts of reasons like that, which are not about practical, mechanical reasons.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's we're in a state of opportunity to go forward and truly embrace the language of this land. A comment, I think it was Kōmākau said to me the other day. She
this
said,
is your daughter.
Yeah. I was labelling some jars that I was making kumaraho, and I said, oh, I haven't put the Latin name on it, Pomaderis kumaraho. She said, people don't want to know that, Mum. They want to know the Māori name. I went, thank you. You know, I thought I'd missed a link because I thought that the whakapapa on these labels also had to acknowledge their Latin names, which I'm versed in. Yes, I know what they are. And I said, oh, I haven't put it on the list. She said, Mum, people don't want to know that going forward. They want to know that that's a totara. You know. And I went, and she said, okay. Like, just really reminding me that's how the reo will survive, as if you give it a place of importance each day, and you have a relationship, you develop that relationship of it's not an economic language, it's a community language.
And I think that's where the alternative ways of thinking, the alternative concepts that aren't about seeing land as a resource, that I think that's where they come from.
Yeah, it's not a resource. It can be, and it's definitely sought after, you know, and it can be sought after, but learn it because it gives you a genuine connection to the whenua and to the place that you're living, and you can understand something deeper, something more special, and you can have that in your kete, your basket of knowledge, mātauranga. And it's got to be good for you.
So we've reached 10 o'clock. Can you say something to wrap up everything we've talked about today? This was like our most wide-ranging discussion we've had.
Yeah.
We're here, there and everywhere.
Yes, I'm hoping that we can continue next year to breathe into this beautiful community through the radio and share many more knowledges and around the medicine, native plant medicine, because there's some awesome medicines that are available to us and easy to use or simple to use and have incredible outcomes. And that we can continue to nourish our reo and our cultural understandings through our communities and genuinely have a community that is solid in bilingualism and biculturalism.
And you'll be doing more classes next year?
Yes, I hope so, if I'm not off somewhere with kōmako.
I know you have many
adventures.
Yeah, many things in your life. That,
yeah.
Yeah. Like, I didn't know you were away 2 weeks ago and doing something completely unexpected from my perspective. So,
yes.
Which we talked about. Go back and listen to the podcast, folks, to find out what we talked about at the start of the show. It is time now for us to go. Thank you for coming in.
Aye, kia ora.
And for everything this year. And, yeah, we'll start again next year.
Yeah, I look forward to that.
Yeah.
So, nga mihi nui.